Okay, if you want an extra copy, you can have this. We're on 50 factors within nations that lead to wealth or poverty. Hold up your hand if you need an outline. This is the fourth and last week. Now, a lot of people still need them. Okay, I'll just wait another minute. Question. How does an evangelical church survive in Beijing of many thousands of people preaching the Bible? You have to have a foreign passport to get in.
To the church?
Yeah, to get into the church. So, now, Rich Shields has set up meetings for us with people who are Chinese people, too, and also a meeting at the embassy. So, but we don't know how much of that interaction we'll have. He said you will be able to interact with Chinese people. But this church is, they give it complete freedom to do what it wants, but no Chinese people can come to it. Isn't that amazing? So should we go and speak there? Well, if it's people from all over Asia, sure. Yeah, a great opportunity. So, and besides, he was there and wanted to set it up for us. So, okay. Yeah, good question. I'm trying to remember your name. Dan and
Carol.
And Carol. Okay. Okay, Carol. Okay, so here is the problem. Luke 4:18, Jesus said that he's come to bring good news to the poor. But in many nations of the world, there are people who profess to be Christians, but their poverty goes on for decade after decade after decade after generation after generation. Why has the good news that Jesus is going to bring to the poor not transformed these poor nations into self-sustaining, growing economies? I believe, and Barry Asmus believes, that it's because there are cultural values and governmental policies and economic policies enforced by law that trap people in perpetual poverty. And so if you want to know whether any individual out of the whole population of the world is rich or poor, the primary question you need to have answered before you know that is, what nation does he live in? He lives in the United States, lives in Australia, lives in England, lives in Northern Europe, lives in Canada. Likely these people will be wealthy, or relatively wealthy according to historical standards and world standards. But if he lives in many other nations of the world where there have been generations of poverty, the system, the national system, traps them in poverty. So that even though they may be industrious, intelligent, hardworking, honest, no matter what they earn, the system takes it away from them or prevents them from earning it. And so we're seeking to transform these factors that trap people in poverty by speaking to Christians who we hope will have influence in these poor nations to change the policies so that people are free to begin to produce economic wealth and transform their nations. So that's what we've been doing for the last 4 weeks. The first 2 weeks, we did these cultural values on pages 1, 2, 3, and 4. Last week, we did governmental policies that lead to sustained economic growth or sustained poverty in a nation. And that was pages 5 and 6 on the outline. Now I'm at the bottom of page 6, and I want to talk this morning about economic policies that lead to sustained economic growth in a nation. And just to give you an overview, Section A is going to do with policies about property, B, the economic system, C, freedoms, D, the source of wealth, and then E, a concluding comment on economic values and higher values. So let's walk through this outline. Point A, number 35, factor number 35. In a society that has sustained economic growth, historically, ownership of private property is widely dispersed throughout the society. I'm going to just ask for a show of hands here. I know you're at different points in life and different circumstances, but how many of you own your own home? Huge number of hands. If I were in one of these poor countries and asked for that, hardly anybody would say that in Christian groups. Why? Because the government owns the property, or the tribe owns the property, or historically in other countries, the emperor has controlled the property, or the king. And so in poor countries, number 35, Well, wait a minute. I'm going to go down to 36 to treat those two together. Number 36, ownership of private property is easily documented in public records. It's not just that you own it, but you have proof that you own it. So you can have, you can get electrical power and phone service because you've got an address to which the bill can come. And the electric company and the power company and the phone company say, okay, I'll give you electricity, I'll give you a phone because I know where you live. I know where your property is. I know I can get my money back if you don't pay. And that you can buy and sell that property because you've got documented ownership, you've got clear title. On the other hand, number 35, in the middle column, economic policies that lead to sustained poverty in a nation, ownership of private property is either prohibited, such as communism, or limited to a very small group in feudalism, or property is owned by the tribe instead of by individual persons. And this will trap every nation in poverty. And then number 36, documented ownership of private property is made nearly impossible by excessive government procedures and bureaucracy. Is that part of communism, really? Absolutely. Karl Marx, in the Communist Manifesto, page 23 in my copy, says this. The theory of the communists may be summed up in a single sentence. Abolition of private property. Abolition of private property. Visit Soviet Union under communism. Visit North Korea. Visit Cuba. Almost no one owns private property. In a pure communist system, nobody does. It's all government controlled. And I think that makes it probably the most dehumanizing economic system ever devised by man. In historical situations in Latin America, this was the pattern for centuries. You had a few large landowners who controlled all the land and made it impossible for anybody else to get a piece of land which he owned and could build and develop value in. In China, the emperor, historically, for centuries, controlled all the land. In India, prior to the British rule in the 18th century, the Mughal princes who ruled regions of India could take whatever they wanted, and people didn't have documented ownership of property. This is also a problem in Africa, where there is a system of tribal ownership of property. I spoke recently to Malcolm Hartnell, who teaches missions at Phoenix Seminary, and he said, it's a problem yet today. Malcolm has spent many years in Africa. He said, you want to buy property to build a church on? And Kurt says he wants to sell you his property. And you say, okay, negotiate a price. And along comes Jack and along comes Pammy. They're cousins. They have a claim to it. They don't like the price. And then Ed and Diane come along. And he's an uncle and an aunt. And they want to have a bit of it. And then your mom would like a little bit of it too. And Mari would like some of it. And you got so many people. And ultimately it's owned by the tribe or the clan rather than by an individual. So how can I buy this land to build a church on? Malcolm said, it's a great problem in Africa to get clear title to a land. Or 2 weeks ago, we had the governor of the Bank of Albania here. We were down at ASU talking with some economics professors about economic system and problems of economic systems in developing countries. And in Albania, they had people owning land and the communists took over, I don't know, 45, 46 with this terrible dictator, abolished all private property. Then, after the communists were excluded, I'm losing my dates, maybe 91 or something like that, government came in and sort of reallocated the property to people, but now you had two people owning it. Prior to communism, they thought they owned it, and then after communism, new people got it. And then new government came in, and they had a new system for distributing land. And so we say to the governor of the Bank of Albania, you've got a beautiful coastline on the Adriatic Sea. Why don't Marriott and Hilton and Sheraton come and build these fabulous resorts and build a tourist industry? You've got water, you've got sun, you're immediately north of Greece. You could have a great tourist industry. And he said, they can't get clear title to the land. And the political system doesn't have the willpower to straighten out the mess, and the court system is corrupt. And so the land sits unproductive. Now, there's a Peruvian economist named Hernando de Soto. He's actually a friend of Barry Asmussen's. And he wrote an amazingly influential book published in 2000 called The Mystery of Capital, Why Capitalism Triumphs in the West and Fails Everywhere Else. He said the secret to the economic growth of the United States was people could move out west, and get stakehold, and they could get documented ownership of a land, of land. And he said, you know what? Businesses are started, half of the new businesses in the United States are started when people take out an extra loan on the value of their property, and they have some money to start a business. And then businesses grow, and businesses produce economic wealth. But you try to do that in Peru? He says. Let me see if I can find this quotation. He and his research team tried to get clear title to, ownership, to license a one person textile or, shop on the outskirts of Lima, Peru. And it took them, with a research team of graduate students working 6 hours a day, months to get a license for this shop, working through 270 some government bureaucracies and forms and papers to fill out. And it would have cost something like 3 years' wages of a laborer just to get license of a shop. How long does it take in Australia? 15 minutes. Or maybe 30. And he said, to get legal title to build a house on a piece of land, about three times that long. It essentially is impossible for poor people in Peru to own property legally and in a documented way, or to license a business. And he said the same thing happens in Haiti, it happens in Egypt, it happens in other countries around the world. You can't get documented ownership of land with private property. Now, what does the Bible say? Exodus 20:15, you shall not steal. And then a few verses later, you shall not covet your neighbor's house or your neighbor's ox or donkey. Why? Because it's your neighbor's. That assumes that the ox, the donkey, and the house belongs to your neighbor. It doesn't belong to you. So you shouldn't steal it, and you shouldn't long in your heart and desire to steal it. It's his. It's not yours. That assumes that there's a system of private ownership embedded even in the Ten Commandments. And there are many other Old Testament verses about property passing down to generation after generation. There are property laws for buying and selling land and how it is, transactions of buying and selling land. The Old Testament assumes an ownership of property. Acts 5:34 in the New Testament. Peter affirmed to Ananias and Sapphira that was their own house or their own land, not their own house. And they didn't have to give away the money. It belonged to them. And so the Bible assumes the opposite of Karl Marx and communism. It assumes the opposite of these systems that prevent private ownership of property. Do you want to see one more example? After church this morning, which way is Shea? Go out to Shea, turn right, and drive to the 101, and then go south on the 101. Over to the right, you will see Scottsdale. And in the non-Indian territory, how much does land cost there per acre right now? $1 million an acre? Something like that? It's unbelievably expensive land. And it can be used for commercial or office or residential. And it has Arizona weather. And it has access to the free. It's amazing. Amazingly valuable land. That's over to the right. But if you look to the left, it's nothing. It's empty, undeveloped, unused land except for a casino that's built there because it's Indian land and it's owned not by individuals but by the tribe. And then you take one of those streets that goes east off of the 101 and you drive into some residential areas and what you see is poverty. You see broken down, unpainted houses, broken down trucks sitting in the front yard. Why? Because the tribe owns the land, not the individual. And you can get a 99-year lease on some of the land, but you can't buy it. So you get some buildings on it. So a few people in the tribe perhaps are getting fabulously wealthy from the casino, but most of the rest of the people are trapped in poverty because there's a lack of private ownership of land. So people can't get ahead. That is an economic policy that's wrongheaded and mistaken even within our nation, sad to say, and it traps people in poverty. Now people say, wait a minute, that's our tradition. That's our tribal tradition. People say that in Africa. People can say that in Native American lands. Fine, but I think Jesus' answer is, for the sake of your tradition, you make void the word of God. People have to choose. Will they choose to follow their tradition and remain in poverty forever? Or will they choose to follow the Bible, the Word of God, and obtain sustained economic development? Okay, that's 35 and 36. Now 37. Free market versus socialism or communism. The dominant economic pattern in countries that have sustained economic growth is private ownership of property and private ownership of the means of production. I've already talked about that as far as scripture. Property belongs to individuals. Private ownership and a free market produces more wealth and increases human liberty, both. And that can be shown historically again and again. That's Barry Asmus's job as an economist to talk about that. Socialism is a system in which the government owns most of the means of production. The railroads are owned by the government. The coal mines are owned by the government. The steel mills are owned by the government. The factories are owned by the government. That's socialism. The healthcare is owned by the government, incidentally. Or communism, the government owns all property. Or tribal system, the tribe owns the property. These trap people in poverty. But now, what does the Bible say about this? If you look, I talked about the Bible on private property, but now if you look at what the Bible says about the role of government, Romans 13:4, it's a terror to those who do wrong. 1 Peter 2:13 to 14, Peter says the government is to praise those who do, 1 Peter 2:13 to 14, I'll read the exact verse, to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. Government is to enforce justice. It is to punish wrongdoers and bless or reward those who do right or do good. Joshua 13 to 21, I put in there in the right column because there's an allocation of the land to families. Note the example of evil rulers in 1 Samuel 8 where the king will take your land. Or note the example of the evil ruler with Ahab and Jezebel trying to take Naboth's vineyard. It belonged to him. He didn't want to sell his family's inheritance and land for any price. But Ahab seized it, and of course that was a wrongful confiscation of property, and God judged him for it. Now, why do I say the free market produces wealth better than socialism or communism? Partly because when people can get the reward of their work, they work hard. How many of you in here have started a business? Oh my goodness, 20. 30 people. Why'd you work so hard, John? To make money. To get the reward from it. Because you could keep it. But if you're working for a government office where your salary is fixed, no matter how hard you work, you're not going to make any more or less. I think you go 9 to 5, or maybe you go 9:15 to 4:45, or maybe you go 9:30 to 3:30, and maybe you just won't work quite so hard because you can't keep the results of your work. That's one thing. Number two, you're free in a free market to decide what works best rather than some government regulation coming down saying you got to fill out this form in triplicate and get it stamped by four other people before you can decide to buy a bolt or a nut for your, to fasten something together. It's just economically unproductive, wasteful activity, good government. Because government doesn't have to become efficient. It doesn't have to face the complexities of competition in the free market. Now, here's the other reason that communism and socialism don't work. It's that nobody in the world and no combination of the people in the world can ever be smart enough to know what the economy needs. And I'm going to say that nobody and no group of people in the world could ever, no committee could ever be smart enough even to know what the shops at the intersection of Shea and Scottsdale Road need. Now think of it. If, let's say that I would like to buy 1 gallon of milk, 12 eggs, 1 banana, and 1 ballpoint pen. So I drive down Shea a few blocks to Scottsdale Road, I turn left, and left again there's a Circle K store. Isn't there a little convenience store there? And if I go in there, you got 12 eggs? Yep. Got a gallon of milk? Yep. Got a banana? Yep. How about a ballpoint pen? Yep. I buy them. Or if you want to go get a pizza, you go to Oregano's. Or there are dozens of other shops and restaurants there. And when you walk into them, they have what you need. How did that happen? It's because mysteriously, over the past several days, little delivery trucks came, and they brought ballpoint pens, or they brought bananas, or they brought milk or eggs. And somehow that shop owner had to know how many eggs to buy and how much milk. Because if you buy too much, it goes bad, and you lose money. If you buy too little, you get an empty shelf, you miss sales, and you lose money. And you know what I think? I think the shop owner in that Circle K, all by himself, knows from life experience and knowing the neighborhood and knowing the seasons of the year and knowing the calendar and knowing the traffic and knowing when the snowbirds come and knowing when the snowbirds leave and knowing what time of day people buy things, that shopper owner knows better than anybody else of the 150 people in this room what to buy in terms of how many eggs and how many milk. Because he's got local, individual, specialized knowledge, and his life earnings depend on getting the right answer. If he makes mistakes again and again and again, buys too much, buys too little, what's going to happen to his business? It goes under. He fails. Good. We need a better business that can keep bananas there when I want them. And milk and eggs. Now, how many people have made the decisions based on their specialized knowledge of the individual needs of the customers and the store and the thing to just those 100 or so shops around the intersection of Scottsdale and Shea? How many people made the decision of how much meat to order for Claim Jumper Restaurant for tonight? And how many delivery trucks decided they're going to schedule meat delivery to Claim Jumper? And how many farmers decided they're going to sell so much to the delivery person so that they... That's thousands of people individually using their specialized knowledge. And you just... If you sat in a hot air balloon for like 24 hours up above Scottsdale and Shea, you'd see just like a hive of ants. You see these little delivery trucks coming and going all hours of day and night. Oh, here's some pens, here's some Frito-Lay potato chips, here's some bananas, here's some milk, here's some eggs. Who makes that happen? Who controls it? Nobody. It's the free market. I think God has given us a system whereby the Circle K owner, working for his own best interest, knows it's best to have bananas on hand when Ellen wants to go in and buy a banana. And there's no committee in the world that could do that even for the intersection of Scottsdale and Shea, to say nothing of the whole United States. But you get a hot air balloon, you go up higher, you get up in a plane or a satellite, and you look over the whole United States, millions of delivery trucks, millions of vendors, millions of suppliers, millions of buyers, millions of shop owners, millions of factory managers, and they're all making decisions to maximize the economic benefit to the nation. Communism cannot do that. No central committee could ever do that. Because no central committee knows all that individual information. So that's why the free market works better. Questions? Way over here, there is a question. What's your name? Susan, do we have a microphone over here for Susan?
Wayne, I have a comment. You're sounding like Barry Asmus every day.
I know, I'm just hanging around Barry too much.
Can you speak to the government system in the Middle East?
The government system in the Middle East?
Yes, regarding property rights and...
Don't know. Oh. It's probably back there in my David Landis book somewhere, but I've forgotten. I think there is, in Muslim countries, the ability to own property. I think that there are other things that hinder economic development. I'm not sure. Okay.
Using your model, you probably don't think universal health care is a good idea.
No.
Thank you.
same deal. I'm not going to go there now. Wait till the fall. Okay.
This isn't a question. It's a commentary. If I go down your whole list,
yep,
and think about what's happened in the last 90 days, we're headed into the poverty column. We have government taking over businesses, banks.
Yep. I'm thinking that too, John. I'm worried about it because increased government control. See, I don't think the Bible teaches that government should control people's property. Individuals own it and control it. So, yeah, this is directly relevant. It's coming out of these biblical principles. I don't think the government should take over banks, Chrysler, General Motors, insurance companies, because Government is not an effective producer of goods and services.
For example,
always inefficient.
For example, Senate dining room.
Yeah.
Amtrak.
Yeah. Okay.
They all honor the law.
Post office.
The post office.
Okay, post office, Amtrak. I don't know about the Senate dining room. They run at a loss. But, yeah. Yep. Okay. All right. That's the 37. 38. The government maintains, how are we doing on time? Not too well. The government maintains a stable currency and inflation is limited to maybe 2%, or it's limited to increases in productivity in the nation each year versus the government allows rampant inflation. The question of inflation is the question of truthfulness in prices and whether you can have confidence in future value. Let's say that I contract with... Let's say Clyde decides to take up a new occupation as a painter. And I say, Clyde, how much does it cost to paint this room in my house? And Clyde says, $200. Okay? When can you do it, Clyde? And I can do it 3 weeks from now. Okay? Fine. And at that time, Clyde knows that a loaf of bread costs $4. I don't know what it costs, but the loaf I like at Wildflower costs $4. And so he figures, you know, I'd like to buy some more loaves of bread. I'd like to buy this or that. I'd like that $200. I'd like to buy a shirt, another shirt, et cetera. Shirt's going to cost $25, and got some other things in mind. So $200, great. But if you live in a country of rampant inflation, when Clyde comes back in 3 weeks, and this happened in post-war Germany, and it's happened in Zimbabwe recently, and it's happened in the Ivory Coast, where inflation just goes 100%, 1,000%, and week after week, prices are just going so high you can't keep up. And I had a student from Ivory Coast saying, people bring wheelbarrows full of currency in order to pay for something because the prices have just gone beyond it. So now, 3 weeks later, Clyde comes back and he says, okay, I'm going to paint that room for $200. I give him the $200. He goes to buy his loaf of bread for $4, and the loaf of bread costs $100 because inflation has just zoomed up the price of everything. So Clyde thought, wait a minute, I painted that whole room for only two loaves of bread? And I can't even buy that shirt anymore. The $25 shirt costs $350. And I only got to... Inflation means you can't predict what anything is going to be worth. You can't make an agreement with the future for buying something. You can't invest and decide that it's going to bring you a reward. You don't know what to... Because everything is out of whack. The price system isn't telling you the truth anymore. You don't know what anything is worth. So inflation, Barry Asmus says, is like a country where nobody tells the truth. And I am worried about the impact of pouring dollars in the government printing dollars in the United States as well, because of the inflation coming. Number 39, the total tax burden is relatively small, maybe 15 to maybe 20%. Versus poor countries, the total tax burden is relatively large. Sometimes, and this, we saw this in some other countries, sometimes it falls primarily on the poor and middle class, while a few wealthy people go free. We saw that with the royalty in Eastern Europe, in the feudal system, with the nobility controlling everything and taxing the poor heavily. And this has been seen historically in other countries. At other times, it falls primarily on the most economically productive members of society. The wealthy are investing in creating businesses and jobs. And they take money from, and the government takes money from the wealthy and takes it to itself. But who can better use the $100,000 that the government's going to take in tax? The Circle K owner locally, who can expand his inventory, or expand his shop, or the housing contractor, or the construction, who can invest it and provide jobs, or the government, who's going to pour it into Amtrak, or into paying government officials who sit in a cavernous file cabinet corridors in Washington, D.C., filling out and filing forms in triplicate and producing no economic benefit for the society, but producing regulations that hinder businesses from creating jobs. So the question is, if the tax burden becomes larger and larger, it hinders economic productivity, and it robs people of individual freedom. So they just don't have the desire to produce or work hard because they don't think they can enjoy the fruits of their labor. Proverbs 29, verse 4. Proverbs 29:4, just hold on a second, says, By justice, a king builds up the land, but he who taxes heavily tears it down. Now, the ESV translation has he who exacts gifts with a margin, he who taxes heavily. It's a question about how to translate the Hebrew. But I think the point is the same. He who demands and requires gifts as a ruler, that's taxation, no matter how you translate it. He who takes things, he who taxes, takes gifts or taxes heavily tears down a nation. Number 40, a economically productive society is one where there are merit rewards. That is, employment and promotion are based on merit. Business agreements are based on the merits and costs of the product. So that those who are best at producing economic value get rewarded. Versus number 40, employment, promotion, and business agreements are based on favoritism and bribes so that jobs and contracts go to less qualified people who are family members and friends. But they don't do their work. And you see this in many, many poor countries. There's just, hey, you're my relative, you're my friend, I give you a job. And you see it in Chicago as well. You laugh. There's somebody in this class who sat in on a contract negotiation with Mayor Daley in Chicago, and he said we had prepared all these estimates and who could do the best. We had a recommendation, and Mayor Daley looked over and saw his friend. Hey, Jerry, you had any roofing contract lately? No. Okay, contract goes to Jerry. I'm not going to say who told me that, but somebody who was in this class. Okay, freedoms. Number 41, what is economically productive? Few regulations. So the burden of government regulation on business is relatively small. Versus number 41, many governmental regulations place significant hindrance on businesses because they have to be filling out forms all day long or following certain other kinds of restrictions. And I'll tell you, in many states in the United States are in danger of this now. I was talking to a Christian who had set up a business in China. I said, wow, isn't it hard to set up a business in China and comply with all the regulations of the communist government there? He said, it's a lot easier than California. Oh, well. Or another factor that in terms of freedoms and regulation, in many poor countries, you have the prevalence of bribery that places unfair disadvantages on honest businesses and unfair, unproductive costs on businesses that do pay bribes. We were in Albania, and I saw what I thought to be a McDonald's, but it wasn't quite a full golden arch. It was kind of a half golden arch, and it didn't say McDonald's on it. It said something, you know, in English, but it was like Donald's restaurant or something, kind of like McDonald's. I said, why isn't there any McDonald's here? Because McDonald's refuses to pay a bribe to the government. And so, am I going to buy a hamburger from the Donald's Half Arch restaurant? I'm not going to risk it because I don't have that reliability, that name brand. If I want a McDonald's hamburger, I want a McDonald's. So now, what has happened? People paying bribes, they can produce less, but they get government protection. And that will destroy the economic productivity of a nation. I don't have in the right column, but there are many verses in the Old Testament about prohibiting bribes. Number 42, ease of starting a business, with few or no monopolies allowed, versus government policies place high barriers to entry for new businesses in many industries. You can't get a license to work here. Skip on because I'm running out of time. 43, domestic freedom of commerce, no tariffs or extortion or unproductive fees, versus 43, domestic barriers to trade. Tariffs, extortion, and economically unproductive fees hinder trade within the nation. In a poor nation, you get all sorts of tariffs and extortion. In Germany, until 1834, you couldn't ship a load of agricultural products. What am I going to use for an example? Tomatoes or potatoes. You couldn't ship a load of tomatoes to market in the big city nearby from your farm without bumping into tolls and extortion along the roads. And you try to ship it by the river, then they had river tolls where people would keep boats from going by. And David Landis says it kept Germany from having an open market for its products and just robbed the economic productivity of the nation. Until 1834. England, by contrast, had abolished all of these local tolls and river fees and everything else. So the whole of England was an open market, and the nation's economy grew. Today in Africa, domestic barriers to trade abound. So Robert Guest is the African editor of The Economist magazine. And in a book called The Shackled Continent, he tells about an experiment. He got on a truck in the port city of in the major port city in Cameroon, and this truck had to make a 300-mile trip to deliver its cargo inland. How long would it take you to drive 300 miles here in Arizona? 6 hours, about. Well, this trip took 4 days because they encountered 47 roadblocks where they had to pay a fine. And, like, for instance, they come to some 2x4s across the road with nails pointed up through them and a man with a gun standing there. And he won't move his 2x4 with nails until he inspects your truck for an hour or two, and then you hand over some money or some of your cargo. And Robert Guest says he was a passenger in the truck, and the guy with the gun said, "It's against the law to carry passengers in the truck." He said this to the driver. And the driver said, "No, it isn't." And the guy with the gun said, "Do you have a gun?" And the driver said, "No." Well, he said, "Well, I do, and it's against the law to have a passenger in your truck. Are you going to pay me the fine or not?" Well, Robert Guest said, because of these checkpoints, or roadblocks, that were extorting money from the truck, they lost one-third of their cargo before they made their delivery 4 days later. What economic benefit comes to a nation where people who are trying to deliver goods lose one-third of their product? There's no economic benefit. It just drains the life out of an economy. Why doesn't the government prevent that? I suppose either because it's not powerful enough or because its friends are profiting. What do you do to get out of poverty? You need domestic freedom of commerce. Number 44, free foreign trade versus high tariffs and numerous quotas. Number 45, freedom to work versus highly restrictive guilds that limit entrance to crafts or occupations. You want to be a blacksmith? You can't. You can't get in. We've got there's a monopoly on blacksmith. You want to be, whatever. Okay, number 46. An economically productive country has freedom to accumulate wealth, so anybody in society is free to accumulate and retain large amounts of wealth by lawful means. People will take risk of investment only if they think they can keep and enjoy their reward. So, John, you're not going to work so hard in building your business. If the government's going to take all of it away, or half of it away from you, you won't work quite as hard. It's true for a small shopkeeper or a poor farmer. And it's true for the wealthy business owner. I think in order to become wealthy, nations have to allow some people to profit immensely and not try to take it away from those wealthy people. Why? Because the Bible has... the property belongs to individuals. It doesn't belong to the government. Now, Forbes magazine just a month ago published a list of all the billionaires in the world. There are 793 of them. I didn't know any of them, incidentally. But it also picture and it's a little more discussion of the 20 wealthiest people in the world. Number one, Bill Gates, Microsoft. Number two, Warren Buffett, who has Geico Insurance. Now, look, I helped both of those guys. I bought computers that had Microsoft products, and my car is insured with Geico Insurance. Why? Because they're a good insurance company. They have reasonable rates, and a couple times I've had claims, they've been fair and honest and prompt in paying the claims. So Warren Buffett got rich off of me. Do I care? No. I say, I'll give you more business next year because you're giving me a good product and good value. Okay, so Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are up at the top of the list. The man who founded IKEA Furniture is up. He's about number 4 or 5. The man who owns Trader Joe's is a German merchant. The man who owns Aldi is up there. And then of those 20 wealthiest people in the world, 4 of them have the same last name. Walton. I mean, if you put all 4 of them together, they're richer than Bill Gates. Now, do I help them stay wealthy? Oh, yeah. I, in fact, have a little list in my mind of things I might buy at Walmart later today. Why? Low price, good quality. Thank you very much, Mr. Walton. Now, a country that allows people to accumulate billions of dollars ends up having businesses that help everybody. They provide everybody with goods at a cheaper, with good goods, real goods, not cheap goods, not fake goods, at a decent price. We all benefit from that. But a country that takes it all away won't let those people prosper, won't have those things, won't have those industries. And then wealth in the poor country is concentrated in the hands of a few powerful people or families, while the vast majority are trapped in poverty. This is the uniform, tragic pattern of nearly all countries trapped in poverty. That is, I'm talking about the wealthy being able to keep their wealth in the United States, where you have people at all points along the spectrum and many people accumulating wealth. But if you have it concentrated in the hand of a few, then Latin America or the Muslim oil countries where few people get the wealth from oil, or Native American tribes where a few profit from the casinos, or Germany and Eastern Europe in earlier centuries with the nobility keeping all the wealth, or Russia before and after 1917 where either the nobility or the communist leaders had all the power and all the wealth, or China where the emperor took everything for himself, or India with the Mughal princes, or Africa with the dictators and strongmen. This is the pattern of very few people trap everybody else in poverty because they keep all the wealth for themselves. Or you have a system where the government confiscates wealth through punitive tax levels, an unjust court system, an inheritance tax, police threats, or social ostracism. That's Russia today. That's Africa. That's many socialist countries. It's feudal lords. And I'm not going to, on the tape, identify them, but someone told me just this morning about a friend who had a successful business in the United States, tried to open a branch in Mexico. It went quite well for a few years, but it was making money, and the government just took it away from him. Now, you think that friend's going to invest in Mexico anymore? No, because you've got a system where wealth is confiscated through punitive tax levels, an unjust court system, or other means. In Africa, social ostracism. You start a little business in Nairobi, Kenya, and you've got a vegetable market, and you're making some more money, and you want to grow your business, and you say, oh, I've got enough money. I could double the size of my vegetable market. I can make more money. But wait a minute. You come home at night, and your cousin wants some of it, and your other cousin wants some of it, and your three brothers and four sisters all want some of it, and why aren't you sharing? And if you don't share all that money with us, you'll be ostracized. And so people aren't allowed to accumulate or grow a business, and it just destroys capital formation and destroys the growth of an economy. Okay, need freedom to accumulate wealth, because property belongs to individuals, not to society, not to your clan, not to your relatives, and not to the government. Property belongs to individuals. It belongs to you. And you can use it as wisely as you can to grow an economy. All right, number 47. Oh, running out of time here. Wealth from producing value, goods or services, versus wealth from just taking things out of the ground like gold or oil or whatever, and that produces dependency. Or wealth comes from grants from other nations. That will trap people in poverty, African nations in poverty, for instance. As the recent book Dead Aid documents extensively. All right, I've got to do 48, 49, 50. If all this happens and people follow these principles and become wealthy, but their hearts are set on money and material goods, it does no good, because Jesus says, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Ecclesiastes 5:10 says, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Luke 6:13 says, no one can serve two masters. And so unless God is put first and we earn money with thanksgiving to him and we use money as stewards, faithful and accountable to him and responsible before him in ways that he is pleased with, all of it will come to nothing. And so an economically successful, truly successful country must have spiritual well-being more important than material wealth. It must count family and friends and joy in life more important than material wealth. And it must worship and serve God, not money. That is the end. I'm going to take 1 or 2 minutes if you just have any other questions. And also afterward, if you think this needs to be corrected or changed, but that's kind of the overview of what we're trying to present. Are you happy with this? Anything else? Thank you. I've never seen it put together before. I don't know if it'll have impact or not, but we're praying that the Lord will let it be used. Okay, Pammy. Hold it.
Why do you suppose Warren Buffett and Microsoft Bill Gates are Democrats? I don't mean that in a bad way. I just, they have so benefited from more of a Republican
policy. I don't know individually, but as far as in general, people have they have political alignments for various reasons. They may not like the Republican view on abortion or pro-life. They may not like the Republican view on marriage, think it's too restrictive. They may be so isolated from the needs of ordinary middle class people that they don't realize that punitive government taxation is really harmful to the economy. And, you know, you can find no end of expert, quote, expert economists who say, oh, the best way to run an economy is for government to control everything. And so, people who get in power think that, okay, everybody else who tried to control an economy from the government in the past has failed, but we can do it better. And, that's why I asked Steve Happel, who's an economist at ASU, I said, you know, aren't there a lot of young economists who are free market advocates today? Yes. But he said the ones in power still think everybody else, and in the elite institutions, everybody else who tried to run an economy from the government control has failed. But we're a new generation now. We'll fix it, and we'll do it better just by putting more money into it. So I think people are just believing falsehoods. They're deceived. Okay. What else? Yeah, John Blackman here. Question, you got to...
Well, I think I could add to that in the sense that I've known some very, very rich people. And there's a tone in my mind that they felt it was their genius and that they were that smart and that they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were excluded from all the other ideas and people. Mm-hmm. They were special. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is part of the problem, that then they don't have to include that in their reasoning with everything else.
They don't understand how ordinary people are affected by these policies.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Good, okay. Last comment, anything else? Okay, let's pray. Lord, thank you for this time together. Thank you for these wonderful men and women and their love for you and for your word. Father, I don't know. I don't know if you will take these principles and use them. And allow me and Barry to articulate them and persuade others, but they seem wise and useful, Lord, and some based directly on your word, some based on what works and produces good results for the nation. But we commit this into your hands. And now for the summer, Lord, we ask for your guidance and direction on everyone here as people travel, as people take up different ministry opportunities, as people fulfill various obligations and responsibilities. Give guidance, give protection, give a closeness to you, a longing for your word, delight in your word and how it speaks to our hearts, and closeness to you in prayer, and bring us back together again in September, we pray. Amen. Thank you. See you end of September.